Leading LDS is a nonprofit organization dedicated to enhancing leadership ability and capacity of lay leaders in order to accelerate the mission of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Leading LDS is not owned nor operated by the LDS Church, and any opinions expressed on this podcast do not reflect the views of any specific organization. All donations given to Leading LDS are tax deductible and go towards the support of Leading LDS. For more information, visit leadinglds.org. Welcome back to the podcast. My name is Kurt Frankham. I am the host of the Leading LDS podcast. Now, one thing you may not know about me is I have one sister. That's right, just one sister, and she is the best. She actually helps me with a lot of these summaries to the various podcast episodes. So when you go to leadinglds.org and see that somebody has written up a very detailed summary, well, that might just well be my sister, and she's a leader in her own right, and I should probably get her on the Leading LDS podcast, but she tells me no. But I digress. In this episode, I had the opportunity to head to downtown Salt Lake City and go to the Church History Library, which I've been to a time or two before, and talk with Kate Holbrook. And Kate is the specialist in women's history at the Church History Department and has put together some fantastic reference books and gathered information that we all need to be aware of, especially those Relief Society sisters. I'm striving more and more to do content that Relief Society sisters would find great value in, because that is such an important leadership role and group in the church. I want to make sure that we're not just focusing on angry bishops and tired elders, quorum presidents. And the Church History Department, with the help of Kate Holbrook, who's one of the authors, has put out a book called At the Pulpit, 185 Years of Discourses by Latter-day Saint Women. And when this book came out, I thought, that's intriguing. So I reached out to the authors, and Kate was kind enough to sit down with me in the Church History Library, and we discuss various points and topics and sisters that were remarkable leaders in the history of our church. And this book contains many of their discourses. So in this interview, Kate talks about some of those discourses, the process she went through to put this book together, and the many leadership principles that come to the surface that we can learn from remarkable women in the history of the church. So here's my interview with Kate Holbrook. I'm back for another field trip at the Church History Library downtown. Did I get that? Is that what we're calling
this? Exactly, yes. Okay.
I've had opportunity to be here a few times, both for personal reasons and to interview some really smart people. And I'm back to interview Kate Holbrook. How are you, Kate?
Doing great. Thanks, Kurt.
Good. So how is it working at this library as a historian?
It's a dream job.
I bet.
I love my job.
It's like your Super Bowl.
I come here and I read and I write. You know, writing can be really intense, but still writing about these topics and figuring out more about the history of women in the church.
Yeah. And I'm sure you have access to documents and things that just send a tingle up your spine when you read some of these things.
They really do. Some of those old Relief Society minute books or young women minute books, you bring them up to your desk and see the handwriting. And it's pretty thrilling.
So what is your title, your role here at the Church History Library?
I'm the managing historian of women's history, which means I write history books and I oversee the projects that we're doing in women's history.
And is this how long has this title been in place, this role?
The title is a little bit new. I was promoted about a year ago, but my position as a person who focuses on women's history was created just before I was hired 5.5 years ago.
Oh, cool. And what led to some of the books that we'll talk about, the book At the Pulpit, the 185 Years of Discourses by Latter-day Saint Women. And you had a significant hand being the compiler and documenter of this, right?
Yes. When I started my job, I replaced Jill Mulvey Durr, who was working here as a historian. And she and I had a conversation. We were overlapping. And at the end of that conversation, I think the next project should be a women's journal of discourses.
Wow.
And so I had to finish up this other book, The First 50 Years of Relief Society, which was terrific to work on. But then immediately knew what I wanted to do next. And all of the permissions and everything that we needed to do this just sailed on through. People were very excited about this idea.
And, you know, I'm no historian, nor do I read a lot of these discourses book cover to cover, which I don't think that's necessarily the intent of these. But it seems like after every president of the church, they get a series of volumes of discourses from their time, right? And so, but this is sort of a new type of discourse book.
Yeah, we don't hear the words of women in our church as often as some of us wish
really?
We would.
I haven't noticed.
And we know sometimes it's hard if you're teaching a lesson or giving a talk to find quotations from women because they're just not quite as accessible as the ones from men. So we wrote this book to give people a help so that you know where you can go if you're giving a talk on faith, if you're teaching a lesson on prayer, important aspects of asking questions and building testimonies. That's all in here. So people now have it in one space they can go to. A portion of the book is already online for free at the Church Historians Press website. And by next March, all of the book will be online for free. So that's pretty handy. You can go there and do word searches. And
So let's back up a little bit and just put your life in context here. Were you always intrigued by history? Was this always the plan before you started college?
It was never the plan. My mom loves church history and she used to drag me to different things and I would just be so bored.
Oh my goodness. And now look at you.
And now look at me. No, I was an English and Russian major as an undergraduate. Wow. And then I did a master's degree at Harvard Divinity School in world religions because I'm so interested in what makes people tick and how they make meaning. And literature is one way to get at that. And religion is one way to get at that. And then a professor invited me to teach a course with him at the end of my master's degree. And we have a book that came out of it called Global Values 101. But really, we'd invite people who were experts in their field to come and lecture to the class about the one thing that they were really great at. And they were all ethical questions, you know, how to improve medical care in Haiti, those kind of questions. And I loved that teaching experience so much, I decided to go on and get a PhD.
Wow. And so you were raised in the church, come from a long line of saints.
Oh, yes. Parley P. Pratt.
And a lot of people came from Parley P. Pratt. So that's great. So during your time of studying, you know, at Harvard Divinity School, what any uniqueness about being a Mormon in this, or having a Mormon background in this, in that type of focus?
I wasn't the only Latter-day Saint there. There were always a few of us there, but it was an important time in helping me learn to stand up for what I believed in, I guess, because often, you know, you'd never, at Harvard Divinity School, it was never okay to say anything mean about a person of color, which is important and good, or about a Buddhist, which is important and good. Yeah. But it was okay to say something mean about an evangelical or about a Mormon.
Interesting. And were these offhanded remarks, or were they?
Yeah, just little snide remarks here and there.
Where if you would have done those in the other context, it would have been like,
people would have jumped all over you. So to be in one of the groups that it was okay to say snide things about occasionally was a little bit uncomfortable, but it was a good growing experience. And I just had to raise my hand in a class and say, oh, you've actually got that wrong, and and speak up for it.
That's great. Yeah. Now, you mentioned this, the study of Russian. Do you speak Russian from a mission, or where did that come from?
Yeah, I was a missionary there. So then I added Russian as a second major when I returned.
Throw that on there.
Yeah.
That's great. Cool. And how would you describe your Russian mission? What was your experience like in general?
You know, growing up, I had all of these fantasies about adventure and sacrifice and being a martyr and all of this. And the Russian mission really appealed to that for me. I loved it because we were the first Americans a lot of people in my mission had seen. I was called to Moscow, but immediately sent to Samara, which was a brand new mission. And so we were, you know, the first missionaries in the different areas, and we were really building things from the ground up. Wow. So
that's
an exciting time.
Yeah. Great memories. And so it was from your master's to your PhD that you took more of a history focus?
Yeah, it was when I was trying to figure out what I wanted to write my dissertation about. I knew I wanted to write about food because that's very interesting to me, and religion and women. And as I thought about those categories, I ended up doing a comparative project that was LDS, history of food in the LDS tradition and in the Nation of Islam tradition, Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali's tradition.
So. Okay, I think I have to schedule another interview with you here. So
food, book will come out.
Food in the LDS tradition. So is it all about funeral potatoes or what?
No, I didn't actually even talk intentionally about funeral potatoes in the book, although I'm happy to talk about it.
I'm just curious. I mean, obviously, we can go a long time in that, but what are some major themes or focuses that surprised you studying food in the LDS culture?
Well, one thing is we sort of assume that what shapes the way we eat is the word of wisdom. And when you look at the recipes that have been really popular at different points in time, it's not the word of wisdom shaping the recipes. It's food storage and our emphasis on self-sufficiency.
Interesting.
So those are some of the things I was able to tease out.
And so is there really a book coming out that you're putting together about
there
food?
There will be. Yeah. The dissertation is done and now I need to
make
it into a book.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I'm intrigued. I'll be back.
Great.
We'll talk about food here in the future.
And then you graduated, you go through, you get your PhD, and then how long until you started working here?
I finished the PhD when I was here.
Okay, great.
I was in a writing group for the dissertation with Jill Mulvey-Durr, who was a historian with a beautiful long record here at the Church History Department. And she came to writing group one day and said, you know, I've decided to retire. And to replace me, they're not just going to replace me by hiring a historian. They're going to replace me by hiring somebody who will specifically focus on women's history. And when I heard that, even though my dissertation wasn't done yet, I thought, wow, that's my job.
Yeah.
I've got to apply for that job.
Wow. So. Wow. And was there much competition? I mean, I would imagine so, but...
Yeah, there was great competition. And a few of the people who also applied at that time work here now.
Oh, cool.
So it's been really happy to see several of us end up here.
And then your first project that you were tasked with, was that the first, was it 50 years of Relief Society?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And what did that entail? Just getting a general history of Relief Society?
It was a documentary history that Jill and Carol Cornwall Madsen had started. They talked about back in the year 2000, but always one of them would have time to work on it when another one wouldn't. So it had never quite gotten finished. Mm-hmm. And Jill was wanting to finish it up when she was finishing her job here. And it turned out to be too massive a project to finish while she was still here. So she ended up helping us quite a bit after she was retired.
Wow. So over how many years did that take to put together?
Well, if you start with the year 2000, then 16, but they weren't continuously working on it there.
Oh, cool.
But it was the first 4 years of my employment here were focused on that book.
Wow. So what's something about the Relief Society that most Relief Society presidents out there should know but don't know? Anything come to mind?
A lot of people don't know that you used to need to apply to be a member of Relief Society in Nauvoo, in the Nauvoo Minutes, which are online. You can read them, you see.
So just to be a member, not to serve in leadership. But
no, to be a member, you would say, I want to join, and then they would consider your name. That early Nauvoo Relief Society, they thought of somewhat as a temple preparation course, although they certainly wouldn't have used those words. And so they tried to be careful about who belonged because they were preparing themselves to be a really righteous society that would progress.
And so would you get a membership card type of thing? And you were
at other times there were membership cards. It went on. It wasn't until the 70s that you automatically became a member of Relief Society if you were a female adult member of the church.
Hmm. And was it always considered an auxiliary of the church? I mean, I would imagine that's the case.
When it was founded, some people referred to it as the Women's Quorum. Hmm. So it was seen more as the female counterpart, not the counterpart to the first presidency. They were the head of everything, but the counterpart to the priesthood organizations. Hmm. So auxiliary makes it sound a little more removed than that original vision.
Interesting. And over time, what's changed the most from where Relief Society is in general now as when it first started?
Oh, that's a big question. a lot of things changed as the church grew. And a lot of the changes we've experienced are in response to massive church growth.
Yeah.
And the Relief Society used to be a lot more involved in local Red Cross organizations, a lot of local boards and organizations, and that slowly fell away as they tried to think how more carefully to focus on ministry to an international church, not a Utah church or a U.S. church.
Yeah. And I think they've done well with that. I mean, it seems to be the case anyways from standpoint.
They're great.
And then after that, was this always the next project on the docket that has moved forward with this discourses book and gathering those?
It was. Yeah. And we brought Jenny Reeder on just as we were getting ready to start on this. And she was terrific and excited about the project. So we divided it in half so that she would work on the part of the book that went through 1920. And then I picked up from 1920 to the present. Hmm. And we wrote introductions to each discourse so that people would get a sense for the historical context of the time when the discourse was given and also the biographical background of the speaker. And those were some of our most exciting discoveries were as we were researching these women's lives, trying to find out what it was like to be a member of the General Relief Society board or what it was like to be a woman whose son was joining the Mormon battalion, you know, back in the 19th century.
So when you start a project like this, I mean, it's an intense project. Where do you start? Do you go in the archives and say anything that was even thought about being written by a woman? Let's put it all in a pile and start looking through it.
We looked through every talk we could get our hands on and already having a talk by a woman recorded narrows things down quite a lot, especially in the 19th century. Sometimes there, the challenge was finding a talk. And we'd go through Relief Society minute books, and Jenny and her team would, and they would find talks with sometimes just a few lines long, something that someone stood and said spontaneously at a Relief Society meeting. So we would include those. And then by the time I was finishing up in the late 20th century and beyond, the challenge was, there are so many recorded talks. How do we choose which one to go with?
So because of that, will there be other volumes that come out, you think?
We don't have a plan for one at the moment, but we're certainly
open to it. There's definitely information to do another one.
There's definitely more to do, and it was a really joyful project to work on.
So now, I mean, it's pretty understood, or I don't know if that's the right word, but there's definitely, we see a model of how women, the sisters, participate in general meetings, you know, in general conference. We have the women's meeting, the women's session, whatever we're calling it. And then throughout the other general sessions, you know, women will speak from the auxiliary presidencies. And what about early on in the church? Was there a consistent routine or model that they did that women were being involved there, or were those quite random?
In the early days of the church, women would speak at testimony meetings and at cottage meetings in more spontaneous settings, but we didn't have sacrament meetings then like we have now. And often if you got together for a church meeting, it was the leaders, you know, Brigham Young would give a speech. So it was male leaders who were more often speaking when there was a combined congregation. But this is part of the reason that Primary and Young Women and Relief Society became so important, because those were spaces where women would get together for a meeting for women, and women would speak at those meetings.
Interesting. And so, and that probably made your task quite difficult, because you couldn't just go to, well, let's look up every general conference and just see when women spoke, because these were sometimes the spontaneous times.
Right. Plus, we wanted to give people access to words that weren't easy to access. So we tried not to get talks that had been given at general conference. We wanted to find those that were a little further off the beaten track that people couldn't find with Dr. Google helping them.
And so when were those talks manifested most? Were there in these cottage meetings, or where did you typically find those?
For the early ones, some were in Relief Society minute books. So the secretary had just written down the words that women had said. Some of them were in the Women's Exponent, the newspaper that was so important to all of the members of the church in helping them keep track of what was going on all throughout the church, and also keep track of what was going on in the nation. They would reprint suffrage articles and other articles in the Women's Exponent, and they would print people's talks.
Interesting. So the Women's Exponent, I'm not familiar with this. So this was a church publication?
It was quasi-official. It was, yes. And often the Relief Society Journal Board would have their meetings in the Exponent offices. And Emmeline Wells, who was the main editor of the newspaper for most of its life, she was on the Relief Society board. And then she ended up being the president of the Relief Society before she died. So the relationship was very tight.
Yeah.
And it was very focused on Relief Society. But it wasn't like today we have the Ensign.
Right.
The church wasn't publishing in that official sense, the Women's Exponent newspaper.
Interesting. So as you went and through this, maybe you'll draw upon the compilation of the Relief Society 51st years of Relief Society. I know. And what's the official?
First thing? 50 years.
First 50 years. Yeah. Sorry, I should have that book in front of me. But, you know, as obviously this, the audience of the leading LDS podcasts are lay leaders, and there's many Relief Society presidents out there that, you know, are sometimes discouraged by their calling and looking for inspiration of other mortals in this world that have lived and led. And as I went through the At the Pulpit book, there's various talks that kind of have that hint of leadership. So are there any specific discourses or individuals that stood out that didn't just talk about, you know, faith or you know, repentance, but really stood and led and challenged the other sisters to rise above their mortality and lead in the world? Any come to mind?
A lot come to mind, because that's what the women who ended up in the book, many of them were doing.
Okay.
Eliza R. Snow was particularly a champion of helping women to stand up and find their voices and speak and contribute. So the talk, we have a couple of talks by her in the book, and you definitely get that sense from her. Belle Spafford, whose picture is on the cover of
the book. I was going to ask you about the cover, how this came to be on the cover.
She's at a pulpit.
Yeah, that helps.
She's the Relief Society General President there. She was the Relief Society General President for nearly 30 years.
Oh, wow.
And on the General Board for nearly 40 years. And President Monson.
Yeah, he's in the background.
He's only been a member of the Quorum of the Twelve for 3 years when this photo was taken in the early 60s.
Very young in that.
Yeah. And then President Marion G. Romney is also behind her. And he'd been a member of the Quorum of the Twelve for 12 years. So she'd been Relief Society General President for twice as long as either of them had been in the in the Quorum
of the
Twelve.
She was the seasoned leader here.
She really was. And she was a fantastic leader. One fun thing about her is she was at the same time Relief Society General President and President of the National Council of Women. And that was the year 1968.
Oh my goodness.
When, you know, a very dramatic year in American history as well with the women's movement and all kinds of things going on. So
interesting. So that she's a good fit for the cover,
She's a good fit for the cover. And she was another woman who really worked hard to help train people and help people see a vision of what they could become. Several of the discourses from the middle 20th century we have access to because they were recorded.
Yeah.
And they were recorded because they were giving at General Relief Society meetings. Mm-hmm. And she was the president for a lot of this time. And these women would give these talks at training meetings at this general meeting when everybody would come to Salt Lake to figure out how to perform in their callings. So a lot of the talks in the mid 20th century do help you. They give you a clear vision of what visiting teaching can be, of what it means to be a member of Relief Society. There's a fantastic talk that was given at a conference for young, for MIA, for both young women and young men, by Elsie Tamlidge Brandley. And she was on the Young Women General Board. And she was, again, giving a vision of how to work with youth, what youth need, how to listen to them, how to go with them on their journey as they entertain questions, and how to also keep them grounded. That I think it's required reading if you're a parent or an aunt or an uncle or have a calling with youth. You got to read this talk.
Yeah. That's cool. Interesting. Now, I think back, you know, on Leading LDS, we, you know, this is interesting of history and things. And I also like to analyze the style of speaking, you know, because as leaders, you're many times asked to stand at a lectern and speak. And we all, you know, the running joke on social media is where everybody gets excited when Elder Holland stands to speak because he has such a style, right, about when he speaks. Or even you think of in olden times, you know, J. Golden Kimball, who there's so many jokes about him and the ways that he used words and such. Who is the J. Golden Kimball amongst the sisters of history of the church?
Well, the person that was most hard to choose just one talk that she had given was Chieko Okazaki. She was a master. Just a master. And she was an educator. So when she spoke, it wasn't only very deep from a doctrinal perspective, but it also was very effective just as an exercise in giving a message that people will really be able to internalize and take home and remember. She, even speaking in general conference, she would use visual aids.
Yeah.
So she really, if you want a lesson in how to give a good talk, or Chieko Okazaki is
and
one
she,
to turn to.
I'm thinking late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, she was in the Relief Society General Presidency from 90 to 97.
That's right. And I'm getting this vision of a book my mother had of hers where she's on the cover with some type of visual aid.
Yeah.
So that makes sense. So she would be one that, like you said, it was difficult to pick just one or two from her.
Right, because every talk was so fantastic. And you learned from the introduction to her discourse in the book that she really tried hard to connect with audiences. And when she first was called, she decided she was going to speak to the different audiences in their languages. So she would have her talks translated and she would practice and practice and practice so that she could deliver the talk the language of the people she was visiting. So,
wow. This is quite timely to say that because I serve my mission in Sacramento, Spanish speaking, and it being in a stake presidency, we have a Spanish ward in our stake and we just had ward conferences. And actually all three members of our stake presidency served Spanish speaking mission, some further
fantastic.
Than others. So we stood in Sacramento meeting and gave our talks in Spanish and I prepared mine. Then I, with the help of Google Translate and other members of their board, got in and read it. And that was very difficult, even though, I mean, conversational for the most part with Spanish, but you know, to read it, and it was harder than I thought. So to hear that,
yeah,
wow. And this was was this her general conference talks or just when she went around?
This is when she was traveling to do training meetings. So like, for example, she was giving one talk in Korea and she just couldn't get the pronunciation down, and the talk had been translated, and then the man who translated it was Gary McElprang, and his wife Sunai was Korean. And so she spoke the words into a tape recorder. so that Sister Okazaki could just practice and practice until she got the translation down. And then she gives the talk and people weep because she's bothered to speak to them in their own language. Yeah. And it was so meaningful to them.
Yeah. And at that time, there wasn't general representatives of the church weren't coming out and speaking their language as maybe they do now.
Yeah.
You know? Wow.
Yeah.
What a great example of leadership to take on that task. Because it would be easy to just say, you know what, I'm not going to learn every language. Yeah, yeah. Use the translator. Yeah. Translator. Wow. That's fascinating. So, and as far as like, was there any evolving style from the olden time, you know, in the 1800s, the 1900s that has changed over time, or as far as from the style standpoint?
Oh, just the language. You know, people were more flowery in the 19th century than they are now. Yeah. And a little more passionate often in the older talks than they are now. The talks in the book are spontaneous then. And now if somebody's going to speak at BYU Women's Conference, they really write it out and polish it before they give it. And it's a much longer talk. So you do see those changes. But we were looking for talks that had a timeless quality about them. Our criteria were you read the talk and you see that it's well written from an aesthetic standpoint. Mm-hmm. It engages doctrine and has some theological analysis in it. And perhaps most important, you read it and you immediately want to go share it with somebody. You want to go post a quote on Facebook. You want to call your mom or your friend and say, listen to this. Wow. So because that was our criteria, you can get that from any talk, regardless of when it was given. You know, even if it's a short talk from 1889, given in the assembly hall or something, or whether it's a long BYU Women's Conference talk, you still feel like, wow, that changed the way I think about this. Huh. Or I know how this week I'm going to work to be a better person.
Yeah. So even back then, there were some quotable moments that...
absolutely. Yeah.
And, you know, we think in the 1800s, obviously, women's rights was at a whole different place, and maybe they weren't given as much opportunity to stand at that lectern. But nonetheless, there were still those moments of, like, you know, you read some of these Lorenzo Snow talks, or, you know, where they're really pounding the pulpit and getting at them. There were similar, you'd say, where women are very passionate as far as how they're talking and challenging those that listen.
Yeah. And they had such a stirring vision of their potential. You know, Relief Society was going to save the world, not just the Mormon world, but the whole world.
Interesting.
And so their vision of all the support they had for the suffrage movement, part of that was we need to restore woman to her rightful place so her voice can be a part of the running of the world.
Wow. That's inspiring, because you think of, you know, I'm just thinking of a local Relief Society president that's called, and, you know, you sort of make sure there's a teacher on Sunday, make sure we have an activity every once in a while. But to approach that calling as, well, this is an organization that's going to change the world. You know, that gives you a different approach.
Yeah.
A different candor as you try and lead that group wherever it is you're located.
They did see that more clearly then than we tend to now. Although I know some Relief Society presidents today that also have a good grand vision.
Absolutely. Yeah. And even in the general councils of Relief Society, I think that's...
Oh, absolutely. The female officers.
Yeah, they're not shying away from their call and their mission. Well, this is, and it was difficult to pick as far as, because you have, you know, which talks, obviously you've mentioned that, but as far as from what time period, because we have so much now as opposed to long ago.
We just decided we would do two or three per decade. And in the early stages, there are a couple where we have three per decade because they were shorter talks. And then we ended up adding a few extra to the later part just because we knew people would want to have a talk from Sherry Dew. We knew there were some people that they wanted to hear from. And so
plus somebody has to walk across the street and put this in Desert Book, and if it doesn't have Sherry Dew. I know she's not like that, but nonetheless.
Sherry Dew's talk in there is actually fantastic. And you learn a little bit about her background that you don't know, that she's incredibly shy and always has been shy.
Yeah, I've heard her talk about that.
Something she's had to fight against to accomplish what she's accomplished. But she talks about learning the language of revelation, learning what it feels like when the Spirit talks to you and how it is like another language. And you can pray for help to learn that other language. And it's one of the most important languages or skills we can acquire in this life. Hmm. That was one of the talks that in this book that's really changed my own spiritual life.
Hmm. Now, looking back, you mentioned you went back through old minutes and agendas of various meetings. What could we learn? What could a Relief Society presidency learn about running a meeting or leading a meeting or even their style of recording meetings that would be helpful for modern day leadership? Anything come to mind?
Well, they were very organized. Like they kept careful notes and they were very organized, which I think is good for us to think about now. They were also very good at mentoring each other and the coming generation. There's a story here where Eliza R. Snow asked, oh my gosh, I'm blanking on her name. Okay. Emily Richards, maybe, to speak at a young women meeting. And Emily was young and she said, no, thank you. I don't have anything to say. And there are a lot of ways that Eliza R. Snow could have responded to that. And what she said was, that's okay, but next time try to have something to say. So loving in the moment, but also pointing towards a growth opportunity. And she did. She ended up speaking at the National Council of Women meeting in Washington, D.C. So she did grow. She did find the courage.
Yeah, great leadership principle. If somebody says no, regardless of what it is, say, well, you know, and challenge them to prepare for the next time.
Yeah.
We need you here. Yeah. We need you part of this society.
Give them love and encourage them to grow.
That's cool. Yeah. That's great. Well, okay, this is intriguing, and I'm excited to learn more. You know, I don't profess to be a great historian, and I'm almost ashamed that I haven't learned more about these women, especially remind me that her name on the cover.
Oh, Belle Spafford.
Belle Spafford. I've got to jump into her history and some of her talks and learn, because I think there's so much to learn from what they've said. And then what about as far as to maybe a bishopric listening? You know, the church is sort of taken I don't know if I'd classify it as a shift, or, but there's definitely an extra focus of women's history happening in the church, obviously with the creation of the position you're in. How can bishoprics maybe make a better focus on the sisters in their ward, and especially the leader sisters in their ward?
That's a terrific question. One thing that's important about the fact that this was published by the Church Historians Press is that means you can use it in church. I mean, you can buy it at the distribution center.
We laugh, but there are some bishops that think, well,
that are really careful. Yeah. Sure. So, you know, quote from it. One way to really make the women in your ward and the young women and the primary girls see that you honor what they have to contribute is to be quoting women and telling stories about women when you're up in front of people, or even when on one in your offices. It's a way to, even having the book on your
desk,
they'll see, oh, look, you know, he cares about experiences of people who are similar to me.
Yeah. And I don't know how the church material centers work these days. I mean, it just seems like there's stuff in there that's ancient and belongs in a museum.
But in the libraries.
Right, yeah, in the libraries. But does the church send out a copy to each material center, or is that up to the local leaders to put one there?
It's up to the local leaders, which is one reason why we'll have the whole thing online, because it's easy for people to access and they don't have to spend money for it.
And will it be in our Gospel Library app as well?
We're working on that. It will be translated into Spanish and Portuguese, which needs to happen before we can put it into the Gospel Library app.
Wow. And Russian. You're working on the Russian one?
I'm not myself, but I would certainly love to see it translated.
You got plenty of things to do around here.
We do have the story of and talk of an inspiring Russian convert in the book.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, there you have it. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, you know, and just what a great gesture it would be for a bishop to be proactive in using this book and recognizing it and promoting it. And, you know, that a great way to do that. I'm glad you mentioned that. My final question, well, before I ask the final question, where would you send people? You mentioned online, but I'm sure Deseret Book and anywhere else that where people should find this information.
Yeah. Deseret Book, the distribution center, Amazon. The Benchmark Books that I love in Murray, Utah.
Okay.
If you have local.
Shout out to Benchmark Books.
Benchmark Books is terrific, and they have it there, and they've even had some copies signed by the author. If you like copies signed by the author, they have them.
Yeah. Nice. Okay. Well, we'll do that. And the final question is, you've obviously, this is sort of your ministry, you know, involved in the history of the women of the church. How have you become a better disciple or follower of Jesus Christ by studying the history of women?
In so many ways, it's hard for me to think which one to say. Mm-hmm. But one way is studying the words of women. They teach me how to be a better disciple of Christ. One of the talks in the book is by a German woman named Jutta Busche. And she talks about how she moved to Utah because her husband became a general authority. And there was a real culture shock for her. And she was questioning, you know, when I teach Relief Society, there's no centerpiece, or it's a wrong looking centerpiece. Am I the right? Am I still a good Mormon? And she worked out between her and her father in heaven what it meant for her to be a disciple of Christ, and that God needs each of us to be a member of the church in the way that we will be a member of the church. We don't have to look to others. She said, we're not here to conform and we're not here to perform. We are here to be transformed by the Spirit of God. That was loaded. That's something that I return to again and again. She also says something about the link between being honest in our hearts and repentance that has changed the way I approach both prayer and repentance. You know, thinking the more open I can be about every thought, the more unashamed I can be in prayer, the more I'm actively repenting and the more God can have a real hand in guiding my life.
I get a little tongue-tied when I'm talking to some really smart people, but Kate, thank you so much for giving of your time and letting me throw some questions at you, some easier to understand than others, but nonetheless, you did a great job answering those, and I got a deeper insight to some sister leaders that I need to research and go back and read some of these talks and appreciate the leadership that's been established through the Relief Society organization. Such an inspired program. As always, all we ask is $1 a month for the content that we produce at Leading LDS. And you can do that by going to leadinglds.org, and there you'll find a big donate button that you can click on and contribute as much as you feel comfortable with. And it will all go towards the good cause of Leading LDS as we strive to enhance the leadership ability and capacity among the lay leaders in the church. Until next time, be a leader, not a calling.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.